Hello, folks.
Talk Radio.
Hey, folks. It's Phil Auerswald. I am the co-instructor, the lead instructor for the Entrepreneurship and Globalization class. And I am hoping that everyone is on and listening and that we've got a smoother start this week than we did last week. If you are and you're on Twitter, go ahead and just tweet out that you're there and hearing it and all is good. And even better than my being on, Matt Flannery is here with us and ready to share some of his recollections, experiences, thoughts. I mean, it's been a pretty long time since I first visited Matt at his offices in San Francisco. And, you know, and back then it already seemed like he had been on a pretty wild ride, but the wild ride has continued. So, Matt, fantastic to have you do this. I know there's a lot of excited folks out there. We've been getting the tweets all day long. And so thanks for being on the show, or the course, I guess, whatever we're talking about, call it.
It's good to be a part of the course or on the show or whatever we want to call it. It's good to be
whatever
here.
Whatever it is, yeah, it's not really clear. Matt, again, you know, the one advantage here is that this whole crew has had both of your cases to read for at least a day here. So I'm hoping that most of the folks on the line have read those, and so they have some background on your story. But you know, as we discussed, I was hoping that we could kind of go back to the very beginning, when you and Jessica taking this trip, and then you're back, you're planning your wedding, and then what comes after that. So can you just kind of take us back to the several origins of the whole concept of Kiva and how it rolled out?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me, and thanks for asking the question. So let's see, the whole story with Kiva really starts when we saw Professor Dr. Yunus speak about his experience with the Grameen Bank at the Stanford Business School, and that would be sort of around the 2003 time frame. I think we saw him speak to a small classroom of about 30 people. It was at night. I really didn't know who he was. I had no introduction to this field. But hearing him speak so humbly and so optimistically really, really changed our lives and set us on a new direction that still continues today. So it was extraordinarily exciting time. We decided to go ahead and get married, and then a few months after that, we took a long trip to East Africa, where we were volunteering with an MFI called the Village Enterprise Fund, which is a very, very small Bay Area nonprofit. And I was just going over there as a video, just to make a video and interview people about, the effect of a loan on their life, how their small business is going, their hopes and their dreams, and trying to document that and essentially just make a small, documentary for the nonprofit that was so nice to host us out there. Through the course of that interaction, I think we had the idea for Kiva. I think if I had to trace back when I really, really had the idea, I was still in San Francisco. Jessica was out in Uganda, and she was calling me from some, small house in the countryside, and I was just struck by how easily it was to be in touch with her via voice and via text message, and how excited she was, and the story she was telling of whether it would be, a fish seller or somebody selling clothes on the side of the street. They just sounded like really, really hopeful stories, and I wanted to follow along with the stories from halfway across the globe. So we were also talking about how they were repaying their loans, and it seemed like the repayment rate was really, really high. So we started wondering, well, couldn't you connect my world over here in San Francisco with her world over there in Uganda? And it didn't seem like anything would stop that. And certainly if people were hearing what I was hearing and the excitement in her voice, they would want to participate too. So I'll stop right there. Just for the first inspiration of Kiva really came from that interaction.
Right. So, So tell me a little bit about what you were doing at the time and, kind of how you saw that concept, in your life. I mean, this is just sort of an idea you'd had. Did you right away think, I can see redirecting, behind this idea? Or was it just kind of a notion that you were sharing and something you were talking about much more informally?
Yeah, well, personally, I was somebody that wanted to start my own business. I was a computer programmer working at TiVo, basically our mission was to help people pause live TV, and I was literally working on the pause bar for a new Comcast cable box. And
I think I've used that pause bar. That was an excellent pause bar.
Thank you.
I
spent many months looking at that thing, making that thing. I can tell you exactly how the graphics work. But, you know, if you knew me at the time, and probably if you know me today, I'm kind of a creative person. I have lots of ideas for businesses, and that's kind of an art form for me, is thinking of new, silly, often stupid business ideas, and I'm sharing with my friends and talking about them. And so I was in a phase, as I would call it, a quarter-life crisis. I think I was like 25, and I was living in San Francisco in the Mission, and I had all these friends doing all these creative things, and I wasn't that jazzed about my job, and I didn't think I could imagine myself working there when I was 40 or 50 years old. I just couldn't imagine my life turning out that way. And so I did this thing where I had an idea every day. So I had a business idea, and I would write it down in my journal every single day. And so I was many, many ideas into the project, and if one of the ideas was promising, I made myself go home that night and write up a little paper about it. And so I wrote all these concept papers about business ideas. That one of them, the ones that got the most traction, I had this idea for an online clothing rental store, and where people were going to rent luxury clothes online. It was pretty infeasible. There was an idea for a robot store, online robots that could get content from the internet. So I had all these wacky ideas, but what I noticed was none of the ideas would really sustain me, or they wouldn't make the cut. Several days after I had the idea, I would stop being excited about it, sort of lose interest. But the idea for Kiva was just one of those ideas. At first, I didn't take it that seriously, but I noticed that even weeks and months later, I was still talking about it, I was still thinking about it, I was still trying to model it out, I was still trying to rev on the concept. So it had some staying power. It captured my imagination for some reason or another. And I think that's really, really important when you're an entrepreneur. I think it would be very hard to start up something and devote your life to something that you didn't really, really love and weren't honestly fascinated by or didn't authentically care about. And so for me, it made all the difference when I thought of Kiva. Was it something I really, really cared about? Something I could imagine devoting my life's work to.
So, one of the things that we were talking about last week was the notion that all of us have a lot of assets that have nothing to do with financial assets, and that tapping into those assets is a really key part of beginning to kind of vision the possibilities of an entrepreneurial idea. I'm kind of imposing this on you, and you can tell me whether or not it's true. But you know, I really thought this notion of you guys, you know, taking your wedding list, right? So you have this concept, and then you're sort of deciding you want to kind of go forward, and kind of using that as the springboard for really launching the beginning of Kiva. Could you just tell us like kind of what happened, and then you know, I want to kind of ask you a little bit more about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, a lot of time passes in this story, but I essentially spent a few months out in Uganda. I was amazed by the different tone of my interactions versus my expectations. So I had an image of Africa, I think, that was created by nonprofits and the media that emphasized warfare and starvation and dangerousness and disease and all sorts of stuff like that. But, you know, anyone that goes over, you know, to the developing world or anywhere really realizes that the stereotypes you have at that place are really blown out of proportion, and people are pretty normal, and they're pretty much just like you and me. And my interactions over there at that time were characterized by strategy and talking shop with entrepreneurs about your goat herding business and the profit margins there, or your fishing business and how the mechanics of that work. So I had all these hopeful interactions about business, And I thought if I could transfer that experience to the masses, we were really, really onto something. And I saw no reason clearly why it wouldn't work. Maybe I had an emotional sense of that it wouldn't work, but intellectually I couldn't prove that it wouldn't work. So I kept going with it. And when I got back, I spent a few months coding up the website, just making a very, very simple experience, you know, with a picture and text and a button, very simple things. And when we got it live, we just emailed our wedding list, which is a few hundred people, and said, you know, one way you could honor our wedding is just taking a risk and lending to these people on this website. There were 7 people at the time, so people were incredibly generous.
Just to calibrate, Matt, how many loans have you made, just volume, dollar volume at this point?
Today or back then?
Today, right now, yeah.
Today we have, the loans on our site have been around 800,000 people, and that's about $300
million. $300 million, 800,000 people, and you're talking, this was 2006?
I think when we first put the website up, that was 2005.
2005, okay. So it's 6 years. This is your first 7 loans. And you've worked your network to kind of get these candidates, and that story is all told. You had a great partner to kind of help you get those initial loan candidates, and you've hacked this site out working in donut shops after hours when you weren't working on the pause button. And then you send this out to your closest friends. I mean, this is why you have a wedding list, is because these are the people you care about most. So that's kind of where you guys are. Now, what do you expect when you send this out? I mean, do you feel like, because one thing is people don't like to ask people they know for help or money or anything. It just feels awkward to them. I mean, did you feel like this was an imposition, or how did you look at that?
Yeah, I did feel like it was an imposition, and I've learned over the years to not think that way. But at the time, I did feel like it was an imposition. I felt like it was weak to ask people for money, and I was embarrassed about that. I was also kind of worried about the risk, because I really had no clue what would happen. I mean, I'm going to wire this money to this pastor in Africa that I've met a few times, and he's going to withdraw the money and then give it out to these 7 people in a pretty rural place in Uganda. He has no systems. He has no accounting background. And then he's going to somehow collect the money back, put it back in the bank account, and wire it back to me. I mean, there's no nonprofit here. There's no audit trail here. This is going through my personal checking account. So I did feel very much like I was putting myself out there and taking a risk. And if it sort of all crashed, I would feel personally ashamed or somehow liable, responsible, criminally negligent. And in the worst case.
It's getting worse and worse.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I had all those fears for sure. I totally remember that feeling, and I remember being at like an Easter party with my family and apologizing for it might not work and worrying about it. And they were to everyone else, it just wasn't a big deal. They're like, dude, I'll put in $50 to your website. It's not a big deal. I'm not going to sue you if it goes wrong. So I figured. You know, what's the worst thing that happens if we lose $3,000? It was $3,000. So what's the worst thing that happens? I don't think any of these people are going to hold it against me. If so, I could probably pay them back. It's not that big of a deal. So I just took a risk.
Right, yeah. Well, and so the risk works out, right? So you fund the initial loans. You're able to scale. Just bring us to, the website crash story. What led up to that, and kind of how you dealt with it when you sort of first realized that you have a possibility to do something pretty big.
Yeah, so you'd have to fast forward a year and a half to get to that point. But after a year and a half, I had quit my – sorry. There's 2 websites. Okay, so I'll start with the first one. About half a year later, all of a sudden, Kiva was featured in some big blogs, especially this blog called Daily KOS, Daily Coast. which at that time was, I think, the world's biggest blog. And so I woke up one morning when I was still working at TiVo, and Kiva was in this blog, Daily Coast, and the website was crashed, and I also got probably hundreds, I don't know, maybe 1,000 emails to my Gmail account, and which I was checking while I was at work, and I just realized this thing is going crazy, and here I am working on this TV interface, and it's impossible to do both because this website that I have on the side is raising, at this point, tens of thousands of dollars every day, and the money is going through my personal checking account, and I have all these customers that are complaining, or they have a lot of demands and questions, and so I was sort of juggling these two worlds at the same time, and at that point, I just completely realized that I could no longer do both things at the same time, and I really had to prioritize, because this one thing, Kiva, was going to blow up if I didn't fix it, and I was putting a lot at risk by neglecting it during the day.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, so this is the thing, though. Again, I know all this because I read your case. I'm just sort of trying to remember it, you know. I mean, you're like a good 9 months into this, right, or something like that?
Yeah, at that point, the website had been up for about 6 months, and it was there was like 50 people total that were trying to get loans on the site.
But you're, you know, you were kind of working all hours, coding before that.
Yeah, so the intervening 6 months was just a total blur. I mean, once you start taking money into the site, you had to build the rest of the site. So I hadn't built the feature for them to repay money, the feature for them to blog, the feature for them to post up a new loan. I had no due diligence infrastructure. I was calling them at night, asking accounting questions and wondering where the money was going, and feeling pretty stressed out, but feeling also really inspired. I also had an experience of feeling potentially competitive. So I learned that other people were working on this idea, especially eBay and eBay.com. At that point, I had it in my mind that they were going to somehow launch a competitor and try to blow me out of the water, which is a completely stupid idea. They weren't going to do that. But that competitive spirit made me just fierce and wanting to claim the idea that I had thought of myself. And I think I felt like I had a lot to prove, and I had a big chip on my shoulder, and it was me against the world, and I wasn't going to stop for anything. So basically, I just exhausted myself. I stayed up all night, many nights a week, for many months in a row.
Yeah, well, I mean, but you sound like a pretty terrible entrepreneur there, Matt. I mean, geez, you had no plan. You got overwhelmed. Couldn't you have just mapped it all out and, you know, done it 9 to 5 and, you know, is that the way it goes?
That is not the way it goes. You know, I think it's better just to start with something small and learn as you go. And anyone that tells you that they have it all figured out ahead of time is either the most talented person that ever lived, or they're crazy, or they're a liar. So for me, I had to learn at every stage of the way and almost be pushed from the behind at every few months with some new realization.
Now, I want to fast forward to a different point in the Kiva's development. I mean, I think people. There's so much, and I mean this sincerely. I have you on the call because, you know, we've known each other for a while, been following your story. You know, I got some pushback last week from a few of the folks in the course because I was being so positive with Umair, but I think Umair's great, and I like your story too. So folks who are waiting for me to kind of go at you critically and attack you are just going to be disappointed. But, you know, I think about your story and what's happened the last few years, one really interesting point was the whole kind of discussion that happened. I'm trying to remember exactly what sparked it, whose post it was or how it got in it, you know, about like, well, you know, Kiva's not really doing what they say. Like, they're not actually lending to individual people. The whole thing is a sham. And, you know, but it's really sort of through these microfinance institutions and all this. And I'm thinking, just go to my journal. He wrote the whole thing in 2007. The whole model's there. It's not like anything was ever hidden. And that's why, you know, I you know, from the beginning, even though I understand understood the critique. I wasn't particularly sympathetic. But anyway, I'm doing a lot of shorthand inside baseball here. Could you could you kind of take us to exactly what the discussion was, what happened, and how you responded? And then we're going to go to some open questions. But I thought that was a really important kind of era.
Yeah, you know, Kiva's had a few, what I would say, minor crises or sagas in our history. One of them happened in 2009, so I'll talk about that one. But we've had our share. I have my share of scar tissue for sure. So the story behind that really communication crisis is what I would say is that you have to look at the whole story as a whole. Starting back in 2006, Kiva started by working with a few pastors in East Africa. I set up the bank accounts in Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania with these pastors. And what these pastors would do, they're sort of not lenders at all. There was no banking infrastructure, so I would just wire them the money to a bank account, their personal bank account. They would withdraw the money and then distribute it to people in their community and personally collect it and wire it back. So those pastors at the time had no spare cash or what we call working capital in their bank account. And so they would wait for the money, and I would send them the money at the end of the month and then disperse it to the borrowers after I wired them the money. And so a wire would take 4 days or whatnot, and every wire cost me $40 at that time, which is, so I was trying to bucket them once a month. And so that's the way the model worked for like a year and a half. And then we started getting all this business that really made that model sort of unscalable, and we had a lot of risk and fraud and due diligence issues when working with individuals that weren't part of an organization that was audited. So we started getting more professional. We hired bankers and credit analysis people and had them traveling around the globe, and we started working with MFIs, microfinance institutions, as you know, the best vessel to both source and administer and collect the loans. Okay, so at this point, we started developing a partnership network. Now it's in 60 countries. So if we're working in Rwanda, we'll work with World Vision, a small branch of World Vision out there, outside of Kigali, or in Nicaragua, an NGO helping people on the Caribbean coast. And so we started working with these organizations that were already lending to poor people in their community, and we just wanted to help them do that more. And so we built a whole infrastructure for that, a whole software package for that, so that they could upload lots of profiles and really scale this business internationally into the, not the millions, but the tens of millions, eventually the hundreds of millions. And as this happened, Kiva continued to have supply crises or shortages. So what I would say is we had run out of loans on the site. We were so successful, we were getting on Oprah and PBS. And we had so much business that we were selling out of loans constantly. And so what the MFIs started doing was they would disperse the loans to the people in the off the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua, for instance, before I would wire them the money. So what started happening was an organization in Cambodia would find somebody, give them the loan, at the same time take the picture, write the profile, put it on the website, and then I would send them the money at the end of the month. And so what was happening was the tight linkage between your funding them and them receiving the money was broken. And so it became a little less connected, although the repayments still went to you, the lender. So if you had lent to that silk weaver in Cambodia, if they didn't repay the loan, you still wouldn't get repaid. But on the front end, they were already getting their loan before we wired them the money. So I had this all explained on the website, but it wasn't explained very well, and I certainly didn't keep up with the explanatory challenge of that complexity. And so people started blogging about this because they could read it all on the website, but they were sort of saying, Kiva isn't explaining this very well, or Kiva's based on the information I'm getting off of their own website, it's different than what you think it is. And so we really had this crisis of negative blogging, negative publicity, based on the perception that Kiva was more fake than the average internet user saw. And I thought some of the criticism was valid. We weren't hiding anything. I mean, all the information they got was from our website, but we certainly oversimplified what was happening on the back end. And that's part of my design philosophy as an entrepreneur. I like to simplify things. I like to make, you know, the website really easy to use and have lots of pictures. And if you want to find out more, you can find out more, but you have to dig a little deeper, and the casual user might not see it, essentially. So what I learned back then was you're only as good as your average user believes you are. So you need to really go over the top in explaining how you work to the average user, even if the average user only spends, you know, 5 minutes a month on your website. You need to educate that person as well. And so since that time, we've over-explained their model. You know, if you check it out, please give me suggestions. It's pretty in-depth. Also, we're getting back to the original model. So another thing we're doing is getting back to the true, what I would call, direct lending model, not through intermediaries. And so right now in Kenya and in the U.S., we're lending directly to people. So in Kenya, we're lending directly to individuals via their mobile phone. So we're tapping into the mobile payment networks. It's really a return to the original model. It's a return to exactly the thing I was writing about in the first innovations paper. To me, it represents the full circle of my work and a return to that. I'll probably write another paper about it once it scales, just to sort of tie the narrative, to complete the narrative, which is a really, really important thing for me. If you want to check that out, it's at zip.kiva.org. So zip.kiva.org is the testing ground for that model with the mobile phones. And we'll probably take it to the mainstream, to the millions, next year.
Yeah, it's kind of cool that now you can say we're going to take it to the millions. You know, it's different than having said that in 2006, like you actually will take it to the millions. That's actually pretty cool. Matt, I got one other question for you, just short question, and then in 3 minutes we'll go to some of the questions from the class. What you just actually, I think, answered my question. I mean, but maybe there's something else you want to bring in. I mean, what are you kind of jazzed about right now? What are you sort of thinking that, you know, you wanted to kind of share with this group of 800 folks from around the world about what Kiva's up to?
Well, the main thing I'm excited about is I think we live in really, really wonderful times. I mean, we're at a point in history where 2.5 billion people are still left out of the world's financial system, but they run very stable businesses and they have very good credit. And the opportunity exists to bring all of those people onto a global stage, both financially and digitally. And so within my lifetime, I think this is going to be the first generation where every human, maybe since Adam and Eve, every person can be connected to every other person in the world if they want to be. And I think that really represents a very exciting opportunity. I hope our work can help make that world a better place, make that global digital village a place where you want to live, where people are connected for a positive reason, with positive intention. And, you know, a lot of bad things can happen when people are connected, but a lot of good things can happen. And I'm excited to emphasize the good. So as mobile phones spread to the most remote parts of the world, I want Kiva to be there as a place for those that were previously left out of the world's financial system, the world's economic system, to have a place to go, a community to go to get support.
Fantastic. Well, that's a huge new direction, and a really really great vision. You haven't let up. I can say that. Listening to you talking now, that's great. So now I'm going to go to a few of the questions we've got from Kiva. So from Laurent Mattson. Aside from social value, what are the tangible returns, project profit margins, ROI of micro lending orgs like Kiva? So how do you define your success? You've got sort of loan volume and you've got number of people, but you know, how do you sort of think about your success?
Well, I would say total impact as the concept. So a nonprofit, any social change organization, I think any corporation actually should evaluate themselves in terms of their impact, not their revenue. So for Akiva, our impact is a factor of breadth, but also depth. And so, you know, the breadth part is easy to measure. The depth part is a lot harder to measure. And the great organizations figure out how to measure depth as well as breadth. Because our society, our economic system is set up to measure breadth. I mean, for us, breadth is number of dollars. So we talk about $300 million. Number of people, we talk about 800,000 borrowers, 1 million users online, 80 staff members, 1,000 volunteers, all that stuff. That stuff is really, really easy to quantify, and it's impressive. But it doesn't begin to tell the full story. There's so much depth and so much richness, more qualitative things going on that are really, really hard to summarize. I'm in our office right now next to 30 Akiva fellows. So we have this fellowship program. We're sending them out into the fields. They'll leave this weekend, you know, to go to places all over the world to work. And they see the depth firsthand. They see an organization reaching into a rural area of a country that was previously unreached. They see a women's empowerment story. They see, you know, a water and sanitation program being developed that was previously undeveloped thanks to our risk-tolerant capital that's being sent out to places that undergo famine and starvation. So it's all that qualitative stuff that has really been my emphasis in trying to figure out how to measure that. And it's not easy. It has to do with storytelling, but there is a way to measure it as well. But you have to sort of create that on your own. It's not handed to you.
Now, I want to follow that up by asking a question from our student in Muscat, in Oman, and I believe it's Ayn Khan, but you can correct me later on. So she wanted to, last week, I don't know if you ever saw this piece, it was from a little while back by Anil Karnani, and it was about, you know, the title of it was Microfinance, This Is Its Mark, and everybody read that last week, and it kind of, you know, the point of that was that essentially that in early stages of development, we need just to build a lot of factories and give people employment, and that, you know, the whole notion of kind of strengthening societies by providing, you know, microloans to small businesses is misguided because you're never really going to get the scale and development that way. So when you encounter those kinds of objections, and by the way, I'm not bringing that up to, you know, some sort of straw man where I think that Karnani is totally off mark and we just need to just sort of take the whole thing down. But I mean, I'm just wondering how you think about that that critique.
Well, I'd say it's neither true nor false. He points out something that resonates with me a lot, which is the overselling of any humanitarian effort or the promotion of any charitable endeavor. You have to be very careful about the frame. Unfortunately, microcredit has been framed in terms of charity. It's been framed in terms of a miracle. It's been framed often by people trying to raise money, quite frankly. And so when you're trying to raise money for something that's very good, you might exaggerate or you might have to speak in, you know, very, very excited terms about the best cases of something and not describe it sort of in a more measured way. And so because of that, things get oversold. And I think the story with microcredit, the headlines that a journalist might most want to write about back in 2003 or the late 90s, the headlines that journalists might want to most emphasize is a miracle story. So they'll find the one miracle of a woman that had a chicken coop, and then the chicken coop went to five chickens and eventually 20 chicken coops, and pretty soon she's running a chicken factory. That story is the one that gets in the headlines, and then it creates the impression in the casual observer that that's a typical story, and that microfinance should always play that role. Now, I didn't know if that was true or false. When I started, I was certainly excited about that story. What I encountered, though, was something potentially even better, certainly more grounded in reality and richer and wonderful over the course of the last 6 years, which is less instant, less exciting, less sensationalistic, but certainly, certainly wonderful in its own way. To me, it's more of a story about people struggling to improve their lives, generation after generation, year after year, building a business, every year increasing the size of their harvest, buying something like a freezer to store fish in, buying a lock so that they can lock up their business at night, putting a roof over their head, sending one kid to school this year instead of zero. It's incremental stories of progress. Microfinance sort of sets the stage for that, but it doesn't cause that. And I think if you're sitting over here in your house in San Francisco and you only have 5 minutes to spend doing something, you want sort of a shortcut or a quick route out or something that's a miracle. And so the microfinance story can really tap into that desire. Unfortunately, the world doesn't work that way. But the world's kind of better than that, actually. These are stories of people working really, really hard, and a savings account and a credit line can enable their success. But I wouldn't say it causes their success. It enables their success. Another way to say it is microfinance increases opportunity, but it doesn't necessarily cause wealth creation. It sets the stage for wealth creation, but it doesn't cause wealth creation. And it certainly isn't the only or even the primary factor for somebody to increase their standard of living. It is just one of many factors. If you're in a place like rural Uganda, where we started Kiva, you're in a place where there might not be access to clean water. There might not be access to education. There might not be access to housing. All of those things are critically important for somebody that wants to improve their life. A bank account, a line of credit, is also important. It's a valid intervention. It's a wonderful thing, but it certainly, in and of itself, doesn't transform a person.
Yeah, I think that's a great response. So you know, the idea is, even if what you're doing, what others are doing, isn't the solution to everything, it doesn't mean that it's not a worthwhile thing to do.
Yes.
Yeah. In the earliest stages, when you were trying to figure out how to organize, this is from Pearl in New Delhi. And you kind of figured out these loan amounts and your sort of basic model. Was this all driven from the borrowers, or did you kind of calibrate that according to what you think was going to be viable on your end? How did you think about the sort of original scale of the loans and what you were providing?
Originally,
and then how that's evolved? Because I saw that you've just posted the biggest loan ever on Kiva, $50,000. So, we've got now crowdfunding sites coming in at a different scale. Right. So, you know, in terms of this issue of scale and other kind of services now coming in that are offering, you know, generally speaking, more than what Kiva borrowers are asking for, how do you see this intersection of different services that are operating at different scales?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've been blown away by things like Kickstarter, and it's really opened my eyes a bit in the last, I'd say, year and a half to think bigger. Kiva is currently in the process of what I would call opening up its platform to all types of good causes and different sizes of projects and loans all around the world. So we recently funded a $15,000 loan to a student to go to university in Kenya. So we're interested in providing tuition loans. Any way that we can help address a social cause for people that are underprivileged or left out in some way. So it's not just for people in poverty. It's for a wide variety of social causes that might contribute to poverty alleviation. The biggest loan ever was I think 2 weeks ago, we funded a $50,000 loan for a solar distributor in Tanzania. So bottom of the pyramid products, SMEs, water and sanitation loans, all that kind of stuff we're interested in to see if our capital can further those causes.
Now this is a question from Elizabeth, who's actually a student here at Mason and part of the in-person class. You guys are all about peer-to-peer, and you're all about kind of building those relationships, virtual relationships between people. You're big enough now. Do you have any interactions with governments? Do you have any actions with other kind of civil society organizations and sort of start to think, you know, strategically and coordinate with any other organizations, aside from providing them, you know, a venue to raise money, just the way you were saying, but you know, at a kind of a larger scale?
Not really, to be honest. We've been pretty devoted to partnering with smallish organizations all around the world, sending money cross-border directly to them or eventually directly to the people that are the recipients of the loans. Kiva is all about disintermediation, so the closer we can get to connecting borrower and lender, we feel the better. So over the course of the next decade, we'll just be trying to strengthen that connection and make it more and more closer. So we don't see a big need to work with governments unless they can enable our growth or if they might potentially disable that from happening as well. So over the course of the years, it's been primarily a regulatory discussion. Different countries have different regulations about internet commerce, currency restrictions. We just launched in India, we haven't launched in India, sorry. We will launch in India soon, but we just got the approvals from the Indian government to work in India. So that was a big multi-year effort that's going to come to pass pretty soon, where we can actually fund borrowers. And we're going to start, I think, in Orissa, some of the poorest people on earth out there. But for years, the Indian government was holding us back from doing that because of all the approvals they need regarding currency transactions and cross-border financial transaction.
But now, how much are you kind of alluded to this, but how actually this is also a question that just came in. I'll get the moving the tweet stream is moving so quickly. From Jack. Jack Roberts. So how much of your work now and your future do you see being in the United States? And in fact, this question of loans, some loans now going from other parts of the world, to the U.S. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Actually, I think we're going to tweet you guys your animated thing that went viral a little while back about your loans. But anyway, I'll let you answer the question I just posed, and we'll tweet that out.
Okay. So we were talking about the USA. We started working in the USA in 2009, and when we did, I was just blown away by the reaction. It was the number one customer service question we had received up until that point in time that was on a topical or issue area, which was, why aren't you working in the U.S.? I see so much need in my backyard. I'm in New Orleans. There's so much need here. Why can't you work with us? Why do we only talk about funding people in Kenya? So that really weighed on my heart quite a bit. And it was a regulatory discussion. Again, we were able to get the approvals, and the U.S. has got a lot more advanced legal system with regard to lending and internet lending. So
you want to use the word advanced?
Well, cumbersome, maybe another word. It was a lot more complicated, and there's a lot more lawyers here, so there's a lot more people to ask, basically, with more opinions. So we figured it out, and we started working in the U.S., and to be honest, it's been, very inspiring. So it's been one of the most inspiring chapters in my career at Kiva, just talking to the borrowers in the U.S., seeing the need for this, seeing how underserved it is just shocking how underserved small businesses are in the U.S., more than you would ever experience when you talk to these small business people in underserved communities, whether that be in Detroit, New Orleans, quite frankly in San Francisco or in Oakland. The need is great. They're completely left out. Our financial system is for the rich in this country, more so than in many other places on the earth, interestingly enough. And so we've been trying to work here. The scale hasn't been as big as I'd hoped. I don't think the pipelines to get to those people are well developed. And so I think, you know, we've worked with thousands of borrowers in the U.S. maybe, or 1,000, but certainly hasn't taken off. And that's because we haven't figured out to get to scale. And certainly the will and the inspiration is there. But just to connect these people to other people, the right people to the right people, has been a challenge. So we're taking our second swing at the bat, at the plate, basically, with this project called Kiva Zip. And it's really, really inspiring. We got it going both in the U.S. and in Kenya. Both markets are really, really interesting. I'm super inspired by the work here in the U.S. The borrowers are doing amazing work. They can repay back the loans. They just need a little bit more grace, a little bit more grace period, a little bit more flexibility, a little bit more of a human touch. And our financial system here for poor people has been predicated on the idea of trying to get people not to repay on time. Credit cards, they dishonor debt, and they incentivize people not to repay on time, which has created a whole perverse view towards debt that we're trying to figure out if we can correct, at least in a small way in our community.
That's it sounds like a natural thing to be working on, and not an easy thing to pull off. I'm going to combine two questions, one from Danny DeGrave and another one from my high school running buddy Tony Daniels, who's signed up for this class, which is great. So, Tony's asking, are there any regulatory changes that would facilitate Kiva's growth? Will Kiva remain a nonprofit? And then Danny kind of extends that and says, what if Bank of America wants to acquire Kiva? What would you do? What if it was the Red Cross? I mean, what if you saw a path to, 10x what Kiva is through an acquisition? Why don't we start with regulatory changes and Kiva remaining a nonprofit?
Great. Yeah. There are a lot of regulatory hurdles, as you can imagine, Tony, that hold back our efforts with internet lending, person-to-person lending in general. It's not just Kiva. It's anyone getting into this work. We have an investment regulation framework that was created in the 50s, the 40s and the 50s really, which basically continues on today, which really is not suited for the internet and prevents us from, primarily charging interest or offering interest to our user base. Because of that, we became a nonprofit. We have 0% interest loans only on the website, which is fine. We've been able to do a lot within that constraint. But imagine if that constraint wasn't there. I'm sure our borrowers in Oakland wouldn't mind paying 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6% interest, some fair interest rate, and potentially we could tap into so much more capital from people willing to do it. So I look forward to the laws opening up, because I think communities can regulate themselves now in a way that governments could never regulate us.
You mean through social media and through other mechanisms?
Through trust networks, through identities, through diversification, all the wonderful mechanisms and tools that the internet's created to protect people's identity, verify identity, diversify risk, lower transaction costs, create real human exchanges between people that would never otherwise exchange. All those tools can be used to self-regulate the community in a way that the SEC could never hope to regulate a community.
But I wanted to kind of, update, I mean, your case talks about the sort of really kind of interesting story about wanting to charge interest and then, kind of getting some counsel on that and ending up with the model that you ended up with. But, with Prosper.com and the crowdfunding, and we've had the Jobs Act and now Startup Act coming through, and so, the whole terrain around constraints to lending seems to be shifting. Since this is a public policy class, maybe it's like one more kind of follow-up on that. In words that we can all understand, I know it's like really complicated, where is that conversation and what does it mean for the future of Kiva in terms of things that are already happening right now in the regulatory domain?
Yeah, I was really excited about the Jobs Act. I thought it could unlock something that we've been wanting to be able to do for a long time. So when I was hearing about it, it sounds wonderful. Unfortunately, I think it sounds a lot better than it actually is. So as I started to look into it, it didn't appear like it would change much. I think it represents a good direction for the country to go, which is enabling crowdfunding, enabling person-to-person investments. And I think the U.S. should be on the forefront of that discussion globally because it's going to happen. It's sort of like civil rights. I think it's going to happen over the course of our lifetime. It's just a matter of governments letting it happen. And it appears like the Jobs Act, where I thought it was a huge leap forward, it seems like a baby step right now to me as I get into it. And it also seems like it might be a baby step that will never even happen or won't happen now because it was so ill-defined or so vaguely defined in the legislation. It has to be defined by the SEC right now. And it's in the hands of the SEC, and who knows what they're going to do with it. They'll probably just try to kill it.
Right. So it's actually not really opened the door the way some of us hoped that it would to a different attitude towards lending at smaller scales.
Not yet. I think it enabled for a nice applause moment on stage for politicians to get together and clap their hands, but the substance really isn't there yet.
So I actually want to end up by not talking about Kiva. I want to just talk about stuff that you see. I mean, you circulate around, obviously, a school awardee, and you have other environments. What are you seeing elsewhere that other people are doing that's been exciting you lately, and why, of course?
Well, I don't know. I'm interested in a whole bunch of things. I guess if I had to answer that question really fast, I would say kind of like I've been talking about all the tools around mobile payments. I think every African country has some sort of mobile payment competition that's heating up, and that's really exciting to watch because I think it's going to spread faster than microfinance. So the amount of quote-unquote bank accounts that hit low-income communities is going to happen through the mechanism of mobile payments much faster than it will through microfinance in the coming few years. And so that's just fascinating, all the cool things that are going to happen as that spreads. And that's really exciting. Over here, I'm in San Francisco. I'm really interested in I'm interested in crowdfunding online. Things like Kickstarter are really fascinating. And whatever happens after the crowdfunding bill, there's just a crap load of different startups trying to take a swing at it. So I'm watching them with eager eyes. Personally, I'm really into ride sharing and crowdsourced transportation stuff. I gave up driving a little while ago, so getting around San Francisco and all the new tools, iPhone apps and Zipcar and all that kind of stuff, I think represents a really exciting trend closer to home for me.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously this entire class is sort of predicated on the notion that there's just an amazing amount of open playing field to do, new projects of the scale of Kiva, in a similar time frame. And so, I certainly agree with you
about mobile. Now, you know, I one other kind of follow up, looking back, you know, what you were talking about in terms of mobile financial services. I mean, you have now an amazing global community, 800,000 people mobilized, you know, across the world. And you know, as this this course, I mean, as you know, we announced this 3 weeks before it launched, and we have I think 800 folks signed up from around the world. Do you see kind of a pathway for Kiva to start to offer other types of resources to support the 800,000 entrepreneurs in your network through you know, kind of education or, you know, other types of services that you can offer, and other also, you know, ways to kind of coordinate, convene, you know, collaborate within the Kiva, the Kiva city? Really, it's even more than the community.
Yeah. Well, I have a few ideas. I'd love everyone's thoughts if you can share those over Twitter. I'm sure the imaginations of you all are much more powerful than just my single imagination, so I'd love to hear it. I think that a few things we'll be doing in the next 12 months are enabling much more direct conversations between borrower and lender on our site. We just connected our Kenyan borrowers to the website. So you can send them a message and they'll get it via text. They can text back and you'll get it via email. So it's a two-way connection between rural Kenyans and internet users on Kiva Zip. So you can imagine that when something like that happens, all sorts of business transfer or communication can transfer two ways, and people can give business advice or trade ideas. Eventually, marketing can happen that way. So our borrowers in the U.S. are using Kiva as a marketing platform, too. So they're trying to engage a community as financiers, but also consumers. So in addition to funding my loan, come to my cafe, and I'll sell you a cup of coffee. So they're using it as a platform. Sort of, it's a little bit like Groupon, but more for a good cause. And
right.
Our lenders just really want to support the businesses. And after you lend to someone, you sort of have your... you have some skin in the game, so you feel more of an affinity towards them. So those are just a few ideas. I'm sure there's a lot more to explore.
That's awesome. Well, this has been just a great conversation, Matt, and you know, I appreciate you taking the time to do this. And as the, I know that there was a lot of energy last week, you know, after the class, and you know, a lot of tweets went out, even from the folks who were up at 2, 3, 4 in the morning, you know, tuning in. You know, if you have a chance to take a look at your Twitter stream and to track the hashtag AshokaUOnline, you know, in the next 24 hours, I'm sure that they'd be, you know, excited if you had some answers to the follow-up questions. You know, but as it is, thanks a lot for taking the time to do this. And I think you covered a lot of really interesting ground. So appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm blown away by how many people are on this call and also tweeting. You're onto something really powerful. You got a lot of people engaged. This is really, really cool. Congratulations.
Well, yeah, I mean, coming from you, that's that's a compliment. But yeah, it's you know, this is early days, I think, not just for this activity, but you know, we are planning at Ashoka U. You know, I'm at George Mason, obviously, but as an external partner, working with Aaron Krampitz and Marina Kim and her team at Ashoka U to roll this out over the next year and have at least 10 courses next summer. You know, with this kind of reach and maybe more. So I think there is something. I agree with you. I think it's really exciting, and I've been totally blown away by the response. You know, and we're glad that you can be part of it. So thanks for joining us. I want to tell the close out. We got about 60 seconds left here. I just want to remind everybody to get on the Booknito platform. That's where we're kind of, you know, having our community interaction. So everybody should be on there, you know, creating your profile, putting on your initial statement, and ultimately your involvement in the class is going to be tracked through that platform. So make sure to do that. Make sure to contribute, and that's kind of our mechanism for keeping up with you all. And Matt, I
you know, I'm trying to build a couple of things so that I can go back to the Skoll World Forum 1 year as not just the journal editor guy, but somebody with an actual activity. So maybe this will be my play. I don't know. But it's been fun until now. So
well, you're on to something. It's hard to get
this
much out.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot, Matt. We're shutting down right now. Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Everyone.